And also don't hesitate to ask or say anything you want to as we go along, because it's important that we stay together as a class. Some of you have looked at the book of Daniel a lot, some just a little, and it's important that you ask anything that you want to as we go along so we can stay together as a class. I was asked to look especially at the last part of the book of Daniel. Although the whole book is important, what the book of Revelation is to the New Testament, the book of Daniel is to the Old. One of the most fascinating books in the Bible, there are two portions of it. First of all, there's a part about the man, the prophet, in the first six chapters, and then his message, the prophecies, in the last six chapters, chapters 7 through 12. That's the main message that he's giving. It gives a panorama of history, but some very practical examples of how to live in the present as well. He gives us some insight into the future from his point of view, but also quite a lot of bearing on how to live in the present. Daniel's visions of the future had a tremendous impact in his life as he was living it. He may have had his head in the clouds, but his feet were always on the ground. So he had both aspects of this. Practically all conservative scholars date the writing of this book to somewhere around 536 BC, when Daniel was right near the end of his life. And I think that's correct. Around 536 BC, this was written. But in other circles, this book has been viciously attacked as a forgery. For example, in the 3rd century, there was a man by the name of Porphyry, who was a philosopher, probably was the first significant unbelieving critic of the book of Daniel. He wrote in about 234 AD, 5 books called Against the Christians, in which he just attempted to eviscerate the church. And he alleged that the book of Daniel was written by somebody living in Judea at the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, in other words, around 165 BC. And the reason for this was, according to Porphyry, predictive prophecy is just flatly impossible. It can't happen. And therefore, the book could not have been written before the events it predicts. And this modern critical view that we have today comes from people like Porphyry. It's just been passed down through the years. Basically still the same as Porphyry's, and for the same reason. Predictive prophecy is impossible, according to many people. This was just a tentative postulation at first when they started talking about it, but by repetition it has now become assumed fact, so that when you pick up, for instance, many commentaries on the book of Daniel, they just assume that it was written less than 200 years before Christ. And the real reason for this attack is the assumption that man is the ultimate being in the universe. Therefore, prophecies and miracles cannot be true, because prophecies and miracles are signs of a supernatural power. Jesus Christ knew that. He said, "Believe me for the works that I do." John chapter 10, verse 38. Those were the miracles. The strange things referenced in the New Testament referred to the miracles. And Jesus also said, "Now I have told you before it comes to pass, that when it comes to pass, you may believe." John 14, 29. So that's prophecy. Miracles and prophecy are two great proofs of God's power. And if you want to do away with the Word of God as a real message from God, then you enter into this process that some of them call demythologizing of the book. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but you wind up with just philosophy. You wind up with no miracles and no prophecies in the Bible. And they call it neo-orthodoxy, which I don't really understand the meaning of that word. It's like grape nuts, you know. What is grape nuts? It's either grapes nor nuts, but yet it's grape nuts. I like it, but I don't know what it is. Or it's like Christian Science. It's neither Christian nor science. And I'm still not sure what it is. I've read a biography of Mary Baker Eddy, and I never could figure out precisely what she was trying to say. So it's like that, and there was a man just fairly recently by the name of Karl Barth who went along with these same ideas, that these things we read about in the Bible didn't really happen in time-space history. He also, though, called them historical, but he had some sort of a super-duper history that I don't think anybody really understands. There were no clocks ticking back there in his history. Just what it was, I don't know, and he was never able to explain it to my satisfaction or a lot of other people. So we need to be aware of how many of the people around us, even religious people, may look at the book of Daniel when we talk with them about it. But what does the Bible say? Job chapter 11, verses 7 and 8. Canst thou by searching find out God? Canst thou find out the Almighty under perfection? It is as high as heaven. What canst thou do? It's deeper than Sheol. What canst thou know? The point there is that we need a revelation from God. And if the Bible is not God's word, then we don't have a revelation from God. We don't have any word from God. We've got nature, but nature doesn't really reveal too much of God to us. It shows that he's a God of order, that he's a God of complexity, but it doesn't reveal a word of God to us. They want to destroy the Bible, and to be successful in destroying the Bible, the book of Daniel is one of the first that has to go. But the bottom line on this for you and me who believe the New Testament is that Jesus Christ believed the book of Daniel, and he called Daniel a prophet. Matthew 24, verse 15. So that pretty well settles it for us, and we don't need to spend any more time thinking about what the critics say until we get into conversations with them. Since we're starting in chapter 7 tonight, this is just a little bit of introduction, but maybe we should look at the first verse of the book just to orient ourselves into the history. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. This is Judah, the southern kingdom. And the Nebuchadnezzar that's mentioned here is the usual Nebuchadnezzar in the Bible. He's mentioned in the first four chapters of the book of Daniel. And he is the Nebuchadnezzar of the Bible. The other Nebuchadnezzar the first died about 1100 years before Christ and had nothing to do with the book of Daniel. So we usually just refer to him as Nebuchadnezzar. But historically, he's Nebuchadnezzar the second, because the first Nebuchadnezzar was in the original Babylonian Empire that starts even as far back as Genesis chapter 10, verse 10, with Nimrod starting Babel, false religion, and confusion. In that old Babylonian Empire, you had Hammurabi, who is a very important and famous king. That you've heard of the Code of Hammurabi, but that was a long time ago. He reigned from about 1792 to 1750 BC, and again has very little to do with the Bible. We're talking here, though, about the Neo-Babylonian Empire. Nebuchadnezzar II is the second king of the Neo-Babylonian Empire, and he reigned from 605 to 562 B.C., after his father Nabopolassar. So we're talking here about the southern kingdom of Judah. The northern kingdom never had one good king, although there were, I think, probably 19 kings up there. They never had one good king. 9 different dynasties of kings, coming to 19 different kings in the northern 10 tribes, but they never had one good king. So they've gone into Assyrian captivity long before this. The southern kingdom is continuing, but now Nebuchadnezzar II is ending it. And that's the context here. Daniel is taken away along with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They were young men at the time, and they were going to be remolded, recast by the Babylonian Empire. Take these Jewish young men, castrate them, change their names, take them away from their home, their family, everything in their culture that they had known, and remake them into people that can help the Babylonian Empire. There were probably 50 to 75 of these young men, most likely. So the Neo-Babylonian Empire is coming in and taking over Judah because Judah has refused to repent. They fell because they preferred idols to God. Later on, when Jerusalem fell again, they fell because they preferred tradition to the Son of God. So in either case, it could have been avoided, but was not avoided. God is using the Babylonians as a chastening agent. By the way, about 100 years before this, in Hezekiah's day, a bunch of Babylonians came over and visited Hezekiah, and Hezekiah showed them everything he had in his house and in his dominion. And then after they were gone, Isaiah came and asked Hezekiah, where were those guys from? And Hezekiah said, oh, they're from a country way far off by the name of Babylon. And Isaiah said, what did they see in your house? And Hezekiah said, oh, they saw every treasure I've got. And that's when Isaiah predicted in Isaiah 39, verse 6, behold, the days come that all that is in thine house and that which thy fathers have laid up in store until this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, saith the Lord. And of thy sons that shall issue from thee, which thou shalt beget, they shall be taken away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. So the fulfillment of this we're seeing right here in the early portion of chapter 1. As we read Daniel 1, that's exactly what's happening, the fulfillment of this. And think of how traumatic this must have been for these young boys. One time we had a visitor here from California by the name of Bert von Halsen. You may remember that. With the elder's permission, I asked him to speak for us on a Sunday evening, and he did, and did a really fine job, I thought. But he was from Holland originally. His name, von Halsen, kind of indicates that kind of a background. But he could remember, as a boy in Holland, the Nazis pounding loudly on the door of his father's house in the middle of the night, and they were just terrified. They didn't know what was going to happen. Fortunately, their family was spared, but a lot of the families around them were not. Same type of thing here. Just went in, destroyed things, took over everything, and carried these young men that they selected, they personally selected these young men, carried them away, and I think it's very likely that they were all made eunuchs. We never read of a wife for Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, or Abednego. And all this happened because the people neither learned from history nor listened to prophecy. There had been a revival in the time of Josiah, but it apparently was attached to his personality so that when he died, the revival died with him. Why was there a Neo-Babylonian Empire in the first place? In Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 6, we find, lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, and for the purposes of our class, we'll just use Chaldeans and Babylonians interchangeably. There is a technical difference, but I don't think you care about it any more than I do. Behold, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation. And verse 12 says, O mighty God, thou hast established them for correction. The Neo-Babylonian Empire virtually began and ended with the captivity of Judah. It was around 70 years long, just like their captivity was, and it seems that God providentially allowed them to come about and be a great power just to punish his people. They looted the house of God in verse 2 to show the impotence of God. They took away Daniel, who turned out to be a tremendous talent. And so much was his fame that Ezekiel actually wrote about him, along with some people who were much more famous than Daniel was at that time. In Ezekiel chapter 14, verses 14 and 20, Ezekiel said, speaking of the city of Jerusalem, even though Noah, Daniel, and Job were in it, they should deliver but their own souls by their righteousness. In other words, even if those three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job were living in the city of Jerusalem, they wouldn't be able to save it. It's too far gone. Jeremiah had made the statement that you shouldn't even pray for the city of Jerusalem. It's just too far gone. So Ezekiel wrote about Daniel right during Daniel's life and put him right between two very famous dead saints, Noah and Job. That says something, I think, about how Daniel was regarded and what his reputation was right during his own lifetime. When Ezekiel wrote that, Daniel was about 50 years of age. Ezekiel had been taken away in the second captivity in 597 B.C. Daniel taken away in 605 B.C. Later, there was a final captivity when the city of Jerusalem was completely destroyed and the temple with it in 586 B.C. So three times this happened in three waves, but this is the first one where Daniel was taken away. Noah and Job had been dead for centuries, and Ezekiel puts Daniel right in between them. I think a man is seldom mentioned like that during his lifetime between two dead heroes that way. So it says a lot about Daniel. Also, the statement was made in the book of Daniel when we had the story of Daniel in the lion's den. The statement was made in verses 4 and 5 of chapter 6 by his enemies that we're not going to find anything against Daniel except we find it related to his religion and his practice of his religion. We're not going to find anything else. There won't be any negligence, something he should have done but neglected to do. There won't be any corruption, something he shouldn't have done but did. We'll only find it with reference to his God. And that's why they had the king, Darius, make a stupid decree to get Daniel into trouble. And that's how he wound up in the lion's den. We'll only find these issues about him related to the law of his God. I'm going to skip a lot of things here, but still looking at chapter 1, I think verse 8 is tremendously important because it sets a background for the entire book. They were trying to change Daniel, and he was very congenial. He was good to his superiors. He cooperated in everything that he could conscientiously do. And yet, within himself, he purposed within his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested. He didn't insist. He didn't demand. But he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. And because he had established a relationship with this man, he was able to get this done. Just a tremendous thing to think about, the way Daniel was able to relate to people all of his life. Some of them didn't like him because he made them look bad. But other than that, especially with his superiors, Daniel was able to relate very well. Here's this project to change these boys from what they were into what Babylon wanted them to be. It was a day-in, day-out barrage, but Daniel purposed in his heart. He remembered what he'd learned back home, and he decided that he was going to live according to that. And this goes on for the next 70 or 80 years, all the rest of his life, after he purposed in his heart. It's an inner conviction. He made up his mind. Remember thou thy Creator in the days of thy youth. He made up his mind, I will walk with God. That word purpose there means in the Hebrew language to collect or to put together, to establish. It's used of making a rope out of various strands. Everything Daniel could remember from his childhood teaching and all his reading that he would do. And we know he could read because later on we find him reading in the book of Jeremiah. He put that all together and decided to live a godly, authentic life. Took strands and principles that he'd learned, and probably he had heard Jeremiah and Habakkuk, and Zephaniah, you just finished studying Habakkuk, probably Daniel had heard Habakkuk speak back home. Maybe he had seen the blessings of Josiah's reform. But at any rate, he pulled everything from his memory that he had learned, the thoughts that he needed right then, and decided to stand on his principles. Interestingly to me, there's not a sign of bitterness on the part of Daniel within this chapter. I cannot imagine the indignity of castration by force. And I'd probably be pretty bitter about it. But we don't have a sign of that in the heart of Daniel. Just determination, but no bitterness. Think of a 14-year-old boy that you know. And what would their reaction be? You know, this Daniel is a special person, and we just need to be aware of that. Because it would have been so easy to rationalize. God let us down by putting us here in the first place, so what do I owe God? Daniel had every reason to compromise, but he just didn't. And he also didn't pass out leaflets encouraging a riot. He didn't carry around signs saying, impeach Aspenaz, who was the prince of the eunuchs. So there's no underground campaign against the authorities here. He just approached his superiors wisely, and he was loved. He was loved. So keep thy heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. Proverbs 4:23. I just thought maybe we should say just a little bit about chapter 2. And we won't cover the story, because I think that you're familiar with it. This is one reason the elders thought that we didn't need the first half of the book, because you're so familiar with these stories. And also, fairly recently, I did some teaching about at least chapters 3, 4, 5, and 6. So no need to reteach that. But I just want to touch on the the interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's image. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and in spite of his wealth, he couldn't buy any sleep, so he called the magicians in to get an interpretation, and they say, well, tell us the dream, and we'll make up an interpretation for you. Anybody can do that, but they were apparently adjuncts of the Babylonian government, and this was their job. So quite a bit of waste, fraud, and abuse in that government that needed to be cut out. But they were called in and couldn't do it, and Daniel was called in, and he could. That's the bottom line here. But he gives us in this interpretation the backbone of biblical prophecy, as I deem it to be. There's a great deal of information in this chapter, but I just want to say a few things about this. Remember the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, there was a great image there, and the various portions of this image indicated different empires that were to come. Nebuchadnezzar, you are this head of gold. So that represented the Babylonian Empire. The silver represented the Medo-Persian Empire. The bronze represented the Grecian Empire. And the iron was Rome. And all of these metals had a great deal to do with that particular civilization. In the city of Babylon, for example, this was a tremendous city. By ancient standards, it was enormous. A 15-mile square, apparently, with walls that were 350 feet high. Just think of that. 350 feet high wall. They also extended far underground, so you couldn't dig under them. But the walls were 87 feet thick. You could have chariot races with chariots four abreast on the top of these 350 feet walls. And there was a moat on the inside that would be hard to get through. There was pasture land and farmland on the inside of these walls so you could grow crops perpetually and nobody could surround you and choke you out through hunger. When they did finally conquer this city, they had to do it by coming in under the wall where the Euphrates River flowed and opening a door and flooding in, because the Euphrates River, constant water supply, did flow right through this city of ancient Babylon. Anyway, I said all that to say this. There were 53 major palaces, and all of them were just oozing with gold leaf. No wonder Nebuchadnezzar was considered to be this head of gold. And later on, when Babylon was taken over, it was all the gold went with it. Medo-Persia was known for silver in a number of ways. The Grecian Empire, they used bronze, which had not been used before. It was a special alloy, which was better than brass. And the Roman Empire was, they used iron in their instruments of war. So all of these metals, it's not just random that are used there. And then the little stone that was cut out of the mountainside without hand destroyed these kingdoms. Daniel 2:44, in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and it shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all of these kingdoms. So it started out small, and it's still growing here 2,000 years later. Just wanted to talk about that before we go on to chapter 7, because chapter 7 is going to be like an overlay over this, just giving us more detail about these same kingdoms. Chapter 5, and we're not going to read chapter 5. This is the story of the handwriting on the wall, the last night of Belshazzar's life. But I just wanted to indicate the kings that we're talking about in the Neo-Babylonian Empire. You may have noticed in your previous readings of the book of Daniel that every chapter, except the last one, begins with a sentence including the name of the ruling monarch at the time, and sometimes even adds what year of his reign it was. So I just wanted to say a word about these Babylonian kings, because when we look at the prophecies in chapter 7 through 12, all of them happen under either a Neo-Babylonian king or a king that came from the empire after that, the Medes and the Persians. So I just wanted to say a little bit about this, although the evidence is fragmentary and we don't know as much about it as we would like. But from 626 to 605, we have Nabopolassar. He's the one who gained the independence for the nation and established the kingdom. Then we've talked about Nebuchadnezzar II from 605 to 562. He reigned for 43 years, and in many ways he was the Babylonian Empire. Not only the longest king, but the strongest king of that. By any measure, he was the greatest king of the empire by far. And then after that, we have a man by the name of Amel Marduk, or Evil Merodach, as he's rendered in some translations of the Bible from 562 to 560. He's referenced in 2 Kings chapter 25, verse 27, Jeremiah 52, verse 31. He's a son of Nebuchadnezzar, and he was assassinated by Nergal-Sar, or Nergal-Sar. Nergal-Sar then reigns from 560 to 556. He's the son-in-law of Nebuchadnezzar and usurped the throne, just took it away, and nobody did anything about it. Then from April 556 to June 556, another guy whose name is Labashi Marduk, and he had another name as well that I've just got in parentheses down there. He was the son of Nergal-Sar and was murdered by Belshazzar. He was known as the child king, and he was beaten to death with a club. It was a bitter time. And then finally, Nabonidus, from 556 to 539, he was the son-in-law of Nebuchadnezzar. The throne was usurped on his behalf and handed to him. He was already aging. He is the father of Belshazzar, who shared the throne during the last part of his reign. Because Nabonidus, though he reigned for 17 years, for 14 of those years, he didn't ever set foot in the city of Babylon itself. He liked to travel around a lot. They called him the archaeologist king. He liked to investigate things that way. So he selected his son Belshazzar as his regent, like an acting king. And it was perfectly proper to call Belshazzar a king, as the text does in chapter 5, verse 1. So with that, I think we're ready to go to chapter 7, unless somebody has something to say. Anybody have anything to ask or say?
These guys never lasted very long.
No. You know, one reason we have a term of 4 years for a president is that people can, ordinarily, they can wait that long. Whoops. Well, there's an interesting thing that doesn't have anything necessarily to do with the lesson, or maybe it does. No, they set it up for 4 years so that you could wait out a president you didn't like and you didn't have to feel compelled to assassinate him. Because if you appoint somebody for life, as normally happens in a dictatorship, they may live a long, long time. So there's more incentive to get rid of them through violent means. That's just, these kings were so proud of themselves, and one of the kings had put his name and the sign of his career on every brick in his kingdom. You know, there were 60 million bricks used in establishing the city of Babylon, and this guy put his name on every one of these bricks. But as they laid these bricks out to dry, somebody's dog came along and stepped on the wet bricks. So kind of putting a realistic tone to the pride of this great king. I just happened to see that as we went by. Whoops. This way, here we go. All right, chapter 7. That's where we really... You ready to start our class on Daniel? I should just say about these four empires that we're going to be looking at in a greater detail here in chapter 7. The Babylonian Empire, every one of these was, I believe, providentially arranged by God on some kind of level, and they all had something to do with the people of God. God is interested in these world empires as they affect his people. It was the Babylonian Empire that burnt the idolatry out of God's people. I said that Jerusalem was destroyed because they preferred idols to God. So the Babylonian Empire came along, put these people in the furnace of captivity for 70 years, and after that, the Jews as a people were never guilty of idolatry again. Jesus accused the Pharisees of his day of many things, but he never once accused them of idolatry because it just wasn't practiced in Judaism. They learned that lesson. So Babylon burnt the idolatry out of God's people. The Persian Empire, Medo-Persian Empire, then sent the Jews back to rebuild the temple, rebuild the city of Jerusalem. The Greek Empire gave us the lingua franca, the Greek language for the New Testament, with more terms that delineate between shades of ideas than any other language ever had, and just the perfect language for the New Testament to be written in. And then the Roman Empire paved the roads over which the gospel was taken. They brought about a Pax Romana, the peace of Rome, so that there wasn't war everywhere that the Apostle Paul was trying to go. and others as they took the gospel along these roads, some of which still exist today. Some of these roads are still in use today that the empire paved at that time. So there's a lot to think about here, and the seventh chapter gets us into more detail. In the first six chapters, there's 198 verses as we have it divided. In the last six chapters, 7 through 12, there's 161 verses. So this should not be a long, drawn-out study, just a few weeks, most likely. But it'll give us a panorama of history. There may be some of you who've never actually looked at this material before, and some of you who've been over it many times and maybe taught it many times. So we need to bear with each other and ask anything that comes to mind. There's no stupid question about it, and it is some rather dense material. A haughty king here in chapter 7 again sees these creatures. Back in chapter 2, I mean, a haughty king saw that image of this statue that talked about these empires. Now, in this chapter, Daniel himself has a dream. Chapter 7, verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions in his head upon his bed, and he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matters. Daniel spake and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven strove upon the great sea. We're talking about the first year of Belshazzar here. This would be the year 553 to 552 B.C. Their calendar didn't begin when ours does, and so we have to use parts of two of our years. The four winds are indicative of destructive influences, just as wind is in our time. We're going to see a lot of symbolic language here where one thing stands for another. And we see that in other places in prophecy, both Old Testament and New, Jeremiah chapter 49, Revelation chapter 7, winds indicate destructive influences in those places as well. In fact, these winds were well known enough that the Greeks later on actually named the winds. The Boreas was the north wind, the Eurus was the east wind, the Zephyrus was the west wind, the Notus was the south wind, and when you take the initial letters of north, east, west, and south together, they make the word news. That's where our word news comes from, something that is to be disseminated north, east, west, and south. Four is the number of the earth, just as three is the number of God. And we read about the four corners of the earth, the four quarters of the earth in Revelation 20. So this is a worldwide phenomenon here. The word strove is used, speaking of political strife that was occurring. And Daniel said he saw this at the striving upon the Great Sea, which would be the Mediterranean Sea, called Mediterranean because to them it was the middle of the earth. They didn't have a clear perspective on the rest of the globe. Most people didn't at that time. So the Mediterranean, as they viewed it, was in the middle of the earth. This was the central sea in Bible times. And as recently as the late Middle Ages, it still was. Italy was still supreme because it was jutting out into the Mediterranean Sea. Spain and Portugal and Britain only became predominant when the New World was discovered by the white men, and those countries were the closest to it. So the focus of importance then shifted from the little Mediterranean world, and suddenly you had ships going back and forth to the New World, bringing materials to Europe, raw materials to Europe, and finished goods to the colonies under the program of mercantilism. This was an area of commerce. And that just started happening about 500 years ago. So for long after Daniel 7, the Mediterranean was deemed to be the center of the world. And the waters are the people. We see this referenced prophetically in the chapter, for instance, that Ronnie just read for us, Isaiah 59, 19. I'll quote it from the King James Bible because I can't quote it from the ESV, which Ronnie read. But when the enemy shall come in like a flood, the Spirit of the Lord shall lift up a standard against him. The enemy comes in like a flood. It's talking about people, an alien army coming in like a flood. And in Revelation 17, John is explicitly told, the waters that you saw are people and nations, tribes and tongues. So waters are a well-known symbol for people. And Daniel is seeing that here. Winds kicking up the frothy waves and the turmoil of political strife. Nimrod had been a hunter of men to make slaves of them. He was an empire builder. He caused those winds to blow, and the winds have been blowing ever since that time. In verse 3, we don't have to wonder what these beasts mean, by the way. In verse 17, we're told these beasts are four kingdoms. These great beasts, which are four kings or kingdoms, which shall arise out of the earth. So sometimes these symbols are explained for us, and I like that because we can't make a mistake about it. We're going to see four kingdoms here, the same four that we saw back in chapter 2, and we're told down in 17 that these are kingdoms. It's not just a trip to the zoo. There are reasons behind these symbols or signs, where a little thing stands for something bigger. Four world empires, as we might call them. In chapter 4, we see Babylon referenced. I'll read chapter 4. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given unto it. The lion is regarded as the king of beasts. And we see this referenced in Judges chapter 14, verse 18. Samson killed a lion one time. When he came back by later, the bees had made honey inside the carcass of that lion. And he used that as a riddle against his wife's people, the Philistines. He gave them this riddle, but they came back to Samson and answered his riddle accurately because he said, "You plowed with my heifer." They had wheedled his wife. They'd threatened her, "We're going to burn your dad's house down," until she told him what the riddle was. She learned it from Samson by her continual crying and finally got out of him. So the riddle was, out of the eater came forth meat and out of the strong came forth sweetness. And they came to Samson and said, "Well, what is sweeter than honey and what is stronger than a lion?" And they had it all figured out. But that was that's a representation of what a lion means in the Bible. What is stronger than a lion? It's the king of beasts. And that's why it's used to represent the Babylonian Empire, I think. Strongest empire in its time, like the king of beasts, is the strongest animal of any given time. Thou, O king, art a king of kings. We saw back in chapter 2 that was Nebuchadnezzar, representative of the Roman Empire. We saw here, sorry, there was a glare. I missed the... it may be 8:01 already. Sorry. We didn't get very far, but Lord willing, next time we'll be able to start right at that passage and probably really cover a lot of ground. Anybody have anything to ask or to say this evening? Go ahead.
I looked up when mankind first thought the world was not flat. It wasn't until around 300 B.C.
Yeah.
In that era. So they were thinking Mediterranean, that was it.
Yeah. Yeah, they didn't know what else there was. Now, there were people in ancient times who pretty well knew that the earth was round, but most people didn't think in those terms. So, yes, they're thinking in terms of this Mediterranean world being their little world and weren't thinking beyond that in most cases. Later on, you know, you see ships going out over the horizon, and the last thing you see disappear is the top mast of the ship because it's going over the curvature of the earth. So eventually we figured it out, and Columbus figured that you could get east by sailing west. Good comment. Anything else? Okay, do we just stop? We just stop, or? Okay. Class dismissed.